Welcome to our Christmas Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. All the stories are from A Family Christmas, selected and introduced by Caroline Kennedy. Mr. Edwards Meets Santa Claus, from Little House on the Prairie, by Laura Ingalls Wilder. The days were short and cold. The wind whistled sharply, but there was no snow. Cold rains were falling. Day after day, the rain fell, pattering on the roof and pouring from the eaves. Mary and Laura stayed close by the fire, sewing their 9-patch quilt blocks or cutting paper dolls from scraps of wrapping paper and hearing the wet sound of the rain. Every night was so cold that they expected to see snow next morning, but in the morning they saw only sad, wet grass. They pressed their noses against the squares of glass in the windows that Pa had made, and they were glad they could see out, but they wished they could see snow. Laura was anxious because Christmas was near and Santa Claus and his reindeer could not travel without snow. Mary was afraid that even if it snowed, Santa Claus could not find them so far away in Indian Territory. When they asked Ma about this, she said she didn't know. "What day is it?" they asked her anxiously. "How many more days till Christmas?" And they counted off the days on their fingers till there was only one more day left. Rain was still falling that morning. There was not one crack in the gray sky. They felt almost sure there would be no Christmas. Still, they kept hoping. Just before noon, the light changed. The clouds broke and drifted apart, shining white in a clear blue sky. The sun shone, birds sang, and thousands of drops of water sparkled on the grasses. But when Ma opened the door to let in the fresh, cold air, they heard the creek roaring. They had not thought about the creek. Now they knew they would have no Christmas because Santa Claus could not cross that roaring creek. Pa came in, bringing a big, fat turkey. If it weighed less than 20 pounds, he said, he'd eat it, feathers and all. He asked Laura, "How's that for a Christmas dinner? Think you can manage one of those drumsticks?" She said yes, she could, but she was sober. Then Mary asked him if the creek was going down, and he said it was still rising. Ma said it was too bad. She hated to think of Mr. Edwards eating his bachelor cooking all alone on Christmas Day. Mr. Edwards had been asked to eat Christmas dinner with them, but Pa shook his head and said a man would risk his neck trying to cross that creek now. "No," he said, "that current's too strong. We'll just have to make up our minds that Edwards won't be here tomorrow." Of course, that meant that Santa Claus could not come either. Laura and Mary tried not to mind too much. They watched Ma dress the wild turkey, and it was a very fat turkey. They were lucky little girls to have a good house to live in and a warm fire to sit by and such a turkey for their Christmas dinner. Ma said so, and it was true. Ma said it was too bad that Santa Claus couldn't come this year, but they were such good girls that he hadn't forgotten them. He would surely come next year. Still, they were not happy. After dinner that night, they washed their hands and faces, buttoned their red flannel nightgowns, tied their nightcap strings, and soberly said their prayers. They lay down in bed and pulled the covers up. It did not seem at all like Christmas time. Pa and Ma sat silent by the fire. After a while, Ma asked why Pa didn't play the fiddle, and he said, "I don't seem to have the heart to, Caroline." After a longer while, Ma suddenly stood up. "I'm going to hang up your stockings, girls," she said. "Maybe something will happen." Laura's heart jumped, but then she thought again of the creek, and she knew nothing could happen. Ma took one of Mary's clean stockings and one of Laura's, and she hung them from the mantel shelf on either side of the fireplace. Laura and Mary watched her over the edge of their bed covers. "Now go to sleep," Ma said, kissing them goodnight. "Morning will come quicker if you're asleep." She sat down again by the fire, and Laura almost went to sleep. She woke up a little when she heard Pa say, "You've only made it worse, Caroline." And she thought she heard Ma say, "No, Charles, there's the white sugar." But perhaps she was dreaming. Then she heard Jack growl savagely. The door latch rattled, and someone said, "Ingalls! Ingalls!" Pa was stirring up the fire, and when he opened the door, Laura saw that it was morning. The outdoors was gray. "Great fish hooks, Edwards. Come in, man. What's happened?" Pa exclaimed. Laura saw the stockings limply dangling, and she scrooged her shut eyes into the pillow. She heard Pa piling wood on the fire, and she heard Mr. Edwards say he had carried his clothes on his head when he swam the creek. His teeth rattled and his voice shivered. He would be all right, he said, as soon as he got warm. It was too big a risk, Edward's pa said. We're glad you're here, but that was too big a risk for a Christmas dinner. Your little ones had to have a Christmas, Mr. Edwards replied. No creek could stop me after I fetched them their gifts from Independence. Laura sat straight up in bed. Did you see Santa Claus? She shouted. I sure did, Mr. Edwards said. Where? When? What did he look like? What did he say? Did he really give you something for us? Mary and Laura cried. Wait a minute, Mr. Edwards laughed. And Ma said she would put the presents in the stockings as Santa Claus intended. She said they mustn't look. Mr. Edwards came and sat on the floor by their bed, and he answered every question they asked him. They honestly tried not to look at Ma, and they didn't quite see what she was doing. When he saw the creek rising, Mr. Edwards said, he had known that Santa Claus could not get across it. But you crossed it, Laura said. Yes, Mr. Edwards replied, but Santa Claus is too old and fat. He couldn't make it where a long, lean razorback like me could do so. And Mr. Edwards reasoned that if Santa Claus couldn't cross the creek, likely he would come no farther south in Independence. Why should he come 40 miles across the prairie only to be turned back? Of course he wouldn't do that. So Mr. Edwards had walked to Independence. In the rain? Mary asked. Mr. Edwards said he wore his rubber coat. And there, coming down the street in Independence, he had met Santa Claus. In the daytime? Laura asked. She hadn't thought that anyone could see Santa Claus in the daytime. No, Mr. Edwards said. It was night, but light shone out across the street from the saloons. Well, the first thing Santa Claus said was, "Hello, Edwards." Did he know you? Mary asked, and Laura asked, "How did you know he was really Santa Claus?" Mr. Edwards said that Santa Claus knew everybody, and he had recognized Santa at once by his whiskers. Santa Claus had the longest, thickest, whitest set of whiskers west of the Mississippi. So Santa Claus said, "Hello, Edwards. Last time I saw you, you were sleeping on a corn shuck bed in Tennessee." And Mr. Edwards well remembered the little pair of red yarn mittens that Santa Claus had left for him that time. Then Santa Claus said, "I understand you're living now down along the Verdigris River. Have you ever met up down yonder with two little young girls named Mary and Laura?" "I surely am acquainted with them," Mr. Edwards replied. "It rests heavy on my mind," said Santa Claus. "They are both of them sweet, pretty, good little young things, and I know they are expecting me. I surely do hate to disappoint two good little girls like them. Yet with the water up the way it is, I can't ever make it across that creek. I can figure no way whatsoever to get to their cabin this year, Edwards," Santa Claus said. "Would you do me the favor to fetch them their gifts this one time?" "I'll do that with pleasure," Mr. Edwards told him. Then Santa Claus and Mr. Edwards stepped across the street to the hitching posts where the pack mule was tied. "Didn't he have his reindeer?" Laura asked. "You know he couldn't," Mary said. "There isn't any snow." "Exactly," said Mr. Edwards. "Santa Claus traveled with a pack mule in the Southwest." And Santa Claus uncinched the pack and looked through it, and he took out the presents for Mary and Laura. "Oh, what are they?" Laura cried, but Mary asked, "Then what did he do?" Then he shook hands with Mr. Edwards, and he swung up on his fine bay horse. Santa Claus rode well for a man of his weight and build, and he tucked his long white whiskers under his bandana. "So long, Edwards," he said, and he rode away on Fort Dodge Trail, leading his pack mule and whistling. Laura and Mary were silent in an instant, thinking of that. Then Ma said, "You may look now, girls." Something was shining bright in the top of Laura's stocking. She squealed and jumped out of bed. So did Mary, but Laura beat her to the fireplace. And the shining thing was a glittering new tin cup. Mary had one exactly like it. These new tin cups were their very own. Now they each had a cup to drink out of. Laura jumped up and down and shouted and laughed, but Mary stood still and looked with shining eyes at her own tin cup. Then they plunged their hands into the stockings again, and they pulled out two long, long sticks of candy. It was peppermint candy, striped red and white. They looked and looked at the beautiful candy, and Laura licked her stick, just one lick. But Mary was not so greedy. She didn't take even one lick of her stick. Those stockings weren't empty yet. Mary and Laura pulled out two small packages. They unwrapped them and each found a little heart-shaped cake. Over their delicate brown tops was sprinkled white sugar. The sparkling grains lay like tiny drifts of snow. The cakes were too pretty to eat. Mary and Laura just looked at them. But at last Laura turned hers over and she nibbled a tiny nibble from underneath where it wouldn't show. And the inside of the little cake was white. It had been made of pure white flour and sweetened with white sugar. Laura and Mary never would have looked in their stockings again. The cups and the cakes and the candy were almost too much. They were too happy to speak. But Ma asked if they were sure the stockings were empty. Then they put their hands down inside them to make sure. And in the very toe of each stocking was a shining, bright new penny. They had never even thought of such a thing as having a penny. Think of having a whole penny for your very own. Think of having a cup and a cake and a stick of candy and a penny. There never had been such a Christmas. Now, of course, right away, Laura and Mary should have thanked Mr. Edwards for bringing those lovely presents all the way from Independence. But they had forgotten all about Mr. Edwards. They had even forgotten Santa Claus. In a minute, they would have remembered, but before they did, Ma said gently, "Aren't you going to thank Mr. Edwards?" "Oh, thank you, Mr. Edwards, thank you," they said, and they meant it with all their hearts. Pa shook Mr. Edwards' hand, too, and shook it again. Pa and Ma and Mr. Edwards acted as if they were almost crying. Laura didn't know why. So she gazed again at her beautiful presents. She looked up again when Ma gasped, and Mr. Edwards was taking sweet potatoes out of his pockets. He said they had helped to balance the package on his head when he swam across the creek. He thought Pa and Ma might like them with the Christmas turkey. There were 9 sweet potatoes. Mr. Edwards had brought them all the way from town, too. It was just too much. Pa said so. "It's too much, Edwards," he said. They never could thank him enough. Mary and Laura were too excited to eat breakfast. They drank the milk from their shining new cups, but they could not swallow the rabbit stew and cornmeal mush. "Don't make them, Charles," Ma said. "It will soon be dinner time." For Christmas dinner, there was the tender, juicy roasted turkey. There were the sweet potatoes baked in the ashes and carefully wiped so that you could eat the good skins, too. There was a loaf of salt-rising bread made from the last of the white flour. And after all that, there were stewed dried blackberries and little cakes. But these little cakes were made with brown sugar, and they did not have white sugar sprinkled over their tops. Then Pa and Ma and Mr. Edwards sat by the fire and talked about Christmas times back in Tennessee and up north in the big woods. But Mary and Laura looked at their beautiful cakes and played with their pennies and drank their water out of their new cups. And little by little they licked and sucked their sticks of candy till each stick was sharp-pointed on the end. That was a happy Christmas. And that story was Mr. Edwards Meets Santa Claus by Laura Ingalls Wilder. The next story is The Puppy Who Wanted a Boy by Jane Thayer. One day Petey, who was a puppy, said to his mother, "I'd like a boy for Christmas." His mother, who was a dog, said she guessed he could have a boy if he was a very good puppy. So the day before Christmas, Petey's mother asked, "Have you been a very good puppy?" "Oh, yes," said Petey. "I guess you've been good," said his mother. "Anyway, you're awfully little. I shall go out and get you a boy for Christmas." But when Petey's mother came back, she looked very much worried. "How would you like a soft white rabbit with pink ears for Christmas?" she said to Petey. "No, thanks," said Petey. "Don't you want a lovely canary?" "No, I just wanted a boy." "How about some guppy fish? They're nice," said Petey's mother. "I don't like fish," said Petey. "I'd like a boy." "Petey," said his mother, "there are no boys to be had." "No boys?" exclaimed Petey in dismay. "Not one could I find. They're terribly short of boys this year." Petey felt as if he couldn't stand it if he didn't have a boy. Finally, his mother said, "There now, there must be a boy somewhere. Perhaps you could find some dog who'd be glad to give his boy away." So Petey hopefully started off. It wasn't long before he saw a collie racing with a boy on a bicycle. Petey trembled with joy. He called out to the collie, "Excuse me, do you want to give your boy away?" But the collie said no, he definitely didn't, in a dreadful tone of voice. Petey sat down. He He watched the collie and his boy on a bicycle until they were out of his sight. I didn't really want a boy on a bicycle anyways. After a while, he saw a red setter playing ball with a boy. Petey was just delighted. But he remembered how cross the collie had been. So he sat down on the sidewalk and called out politely, "Excuse me, do you want to give your boy away?" But the setter said, "No, he definitely didn't," in a terrifying tone of voice. "Oh, well," said Petey, trotting off. "I don't think playing ball is much." Soon Petey came to a bulldog sitting in a car with a boy. Petey was pleased, for he was getting a little tired from so much walking. So he called out loudly, but very politely, "Excuse me, do you want to give your boy away?" But the bulldog said, "No, he definitely didn't," and he growled in Petey's face. "Oh, dear," said Petey. He ran off behind a house and stayed there until the bulldog and his boy drove away. "Well, who wants to go riding in a car?" "Pff, not me," said Petey. After a while, he met a Scotty walking with his boy and carrying a package in his mouth. "Now, that is a good kind of boy," said Petey. "If I had a boy to take walks with and carry packages for, there might be some dog biscuit or cookies in the package." He stayed across the street and shouted at the top of his lungs, but polite as could be, "Excuse me, do you want to give your boy away?" The Scotty had his mouth full of package, but he managed to say, "No, he definitely didn't," and he showed his sharp teeth at Petey. "I guess that wasn't the kind of boy I wanted either," said poor Petey. "But my goodness, where will I find a boy?" Petey went on and on. He saw Irish terriers, Scotch terriers, Skye terriers. He saw foxhounds, greyhounds, wolfhounds. He saw pointers, setters, spaniels, beagles, chows. He asked every dog politely, but he couldn't find a single dog who would give his boy away. Petey's ears began to droop. His tail grew limp. His legs were so tired. My mother was right, he thought. There isn't a boy to be had. As it was getting dark, he came to a large building on the very edge of town. Petey was going by very slowly because his paws hurt when he saw a sign over the door. The sign said, "Orphan's Home." "I know what orphans are," Petey said to himself. "They're children who have no mother and no dog to take care of them either. Maybe I could find a boy here." He padded slowly up the walk of the orphan's home. He was so tired he could hardly lift his paws. Then Petey stopped. He listened. He could hear music. He looked. Through the window he could see a lighted Christmas tree and children singing carols. On the front step of the orphan's home, all by himself, sat a boy. He was not a very big boy. He looked lonely. Petey gave a glad little cry. He forgot about being tired. He leaped up the walk and landed in the boy's lap. Sniff, snip, went Petey's little nose. Wiggle, wag, went Petey's tail. He licked the boy with his warm, wet tongue. How glad the boy was to see Petey. He put both his arms around the little dog and hugged him tight. Then the front door opened. "Goodness, Dickie," a lady said. "What are you doing out here? Come on in to the Christmas tree." Petey sat very still. The boy looked up at the lady. Then he looked down at Petey. Petey began to tremble. Would the boy go in and leave him? But the boy said, "I've got a puppy. Can he come too?" "A puppy?" The lady came over and looked down at Petey. "Why," she said, "you're a nice dog. Wherever did you come from? Yes, bring him in." "Come on, puppy," said the boy, and in they scampered. A crowd of boys was playing around the Christmas tree. They all rushed at Petey. They all wanted to pick him up. They all wanted to pet him. Petey wagged his tail. He wagged his fat little body. He frisked about and licked every boy who came near. "Can he stay?" the boys asked. "Yes," said the lady. "He may stay." Petey wriggled away from the hands that petted him. Dickie was the one he loved best. "But who would ever think," said Petey to himself, "that I'd get 50 boys for Christmas?" And that story was The Puppy Who Wanted a Boy by Jane Thayer. The next story is Christmas by Vladimir Nabokov. 1. After walking back from the village to his manor across the dimming snows, Slepstov sat down in a corner on a plush-covered chair which he had never remembered using before. It was the kind of thing that happens after some great calamity. Not your brother, but a chance acquaintance, a vague country neighbor to whom you had never paid much attention, with whom, in normal times, you exchanged scarcely a word, is the one who comforts you wisely and gently, and hands you your dropped hat after the funeral service is over, and you are reeling from grief, your teeth chattering, your eyes blinded by tears. The same can be said of inanimate objects. Any room, even the coziest and the most absurdly small, in the little used wing of a great country house, has an unlived-in corner. And it was in such a corner in which Slepstoff sat. The wing was connected by a wooden gallery, now encumbered with our huge North Russian snowdrifts, to the master house, used only in summer. There was no need to awaken it, to heat it. The master had come from Petersburg for only a couple of days and had settled in the annex, where it was a simple matter to get the stoves of white Dutch tile going. The master sat in his corner on that plush chair as in a doctor's waiting room. The room floated in darkness. The dense blue of early evening filtered through the crystal feathers of frost on the window pane. Ivan, the quiet, portly valet who had recently shaved off his mustache and now looked like his late father, the family butler, brought in a kerosene lamp, all trimmed and brimming with light. He set it on a small table and noiselessly caged it within its pink silk shade. For an instant, a tilted mirror reflected his lit ear and cropped gray hair. Then he withdrew, and the door gave a subdued creak. Slepsov raised his hand from his knee and slowly examined it. A drop of candle wax had stuck and hardened in a thin fold of skin between two fingers. He spread his fingers and the little white scale cracked, too. The following morning, after a night spent in nonsensical fragmentary dreams totally unrelated to his grief, as Slepsov stepped out into the cold veranda, a floorboard emitted a merry pistol crack underfoot, and the reflections of the many-colored panes formed paradisal lozenges on the whitewashed cushionless window seats. The outer door resisted at first, then opened with a luscious crunch, and the dazzling frost hit his face. The reddish sand providently sprinkled on the ice-coating the porch steps resembled cinnamon, and thick icicles shot with greenish-blue hung from the eaves. The snowdrifts reached all the way to the windows of the annex, tightly gripping the snug little wooden structure in their frosty clutches. The creamy white mounds of what were flower beds in summer swelled slightly above the level of snow in front of the porch, and farther off loomed the radiance of the park, where every black branchlet was rimmed with silver, and the firs seemed to draw in their green paws under the bright, plump load. Wearing high felt boots and a short fur-lined coat, with a caracol collar, Slepstoff strode off slowly along a straight path, the only one cleared of snow, into that blinding, distant landscape. He was amazed to be still alive and able to perceive the brilliance of the snow and feel his front teeth ache from the cold. He even noticed that a snow-covered bush resembled a fountain and that a dog had left a series of saffron marks on the slope of a snowdrift, which had burned through its crust. A little farther, the supports of a footbridge stuck out of the snow, and there Slepstoff stopped. Bitterly, angrily, he pushed the thick, fluffy covering off the parapet. He vividly recalled how this bridge looked in summer. There was his son walking along the slippery planks, flecked with aments, and deftly plucking off with his net a butterfly that had settled on the railing. Now the boy sees his father. Forever lost laughter plays on his face under the turned-down brim of a straw hat burned dark by the sun. His hand toys with the chainlet of the leather purse attached to his belt. His dear, smooth, suntanned legs in their serge shorts and soaked sandals assume their usual cheerful, widespread stance. Just recently in Petersburg, after having babbled in his delirium about school, about his bicycle, about some great oriental moth, he died. And yesterday Slepstoff had taken the coffin, weighed down, it seemed, with an entire lifetime, to the country, into the family vault near the village church. It was quiet as it can be on a bright, frosty day. Slepstoff raised his leg high, stepped off the path, and leaving blue pits behind him in the snow, made his way among the trunks of amazingly white trees to the spot where the park dropped off toward the river. Far below, ice blocks sparkled near a hole cut in the smooth expanse of white, and on the opposite bank, very straight columns of pink smoke stood above the snowy roofs of log cabins. Slepstoff took off his caracol cap and leaned against a tree trunk. Somewhere far away, peasants were chopping wood. Every blow bounced resonantly skyward, and beyond the light silver mist of trees, high above the squat isbas, the sun caught the equanimous radiance of the cross on the church. 3. That was where he headed after lunch, in an old sleigh with a high straight back. The cod of the black stallion clacked strongly in the frosty air, the white plumes of low branches glided overhead, and the ruts in front gave off a silvery blue sheen. When he arrived, he sat for an hour or so by the grave, resting a heavy woolen-gloved hand on the iron of the railing that burned his hand through the wool. He came home with a slight sense of disappointment, as if there, in the burial vault, he had been even further removed from his son than here, where the countless summer tracks of his rapid sandals were preserved beneath the snow. In the evening, overcome by a fit of intense sadness, he had the main house unlocked. When the door swung open with a weighty wail and a whiff of special unwintry coolness came from the sonorous iron-barred vestibule, Slepstoff took the lamp with its tin reflector from the watchman's hand and entered the house alone. The parquet floors crackled eerily under his step. Room after room filled with yellow light, and the shrouded furniture seemed unfamiliar. Instead of a tinkling chandelier, a soundless bag hung from the ceiling, and Slepstoff's enormous shadow, slowly extending one arm, floated against the wall and over the gray squares of curtained paintings. He went into the room which had been his son's study in summer, set the lamp on the window's ledge, and, breaking his fingernails as he did so, opened the folding shutters, even though all was darkness outside. In the blue glass, the yellow flame of the slightly smoky lamp appeared, and his large beaded face showed momentarily. He sat down at the bare desk and sternly, from under bent brows, examined the pale wallpaper with its garlands of bluish roses. A narrow office-like cabinet with sliding doors from top to bottom, the couch and armchairs under slipcovers, and suddenly, dropping his head onto the desk, he started to shake, passionately, noisily, pressing first his lips, then his wet cheek to the cold, dusty wood and clutching at its far corners. In the desk he found a notebook, spreading boards, supplies of black pins, and an English biscuit tin that contained a large exotic cocoon which had cost 3 rubles. It was papery to the touch and seemed made of a brown folded leaf. His son had remembered it during his sickness, regretting that he had left it behind, but consoling himself with the thought that the chrysalid inside was probably dead. He also found a torn net, a tarlatan bag on a collapsible hoop, and the muslin still smelled of summer and sun-hot grass. Then, bending lower and lower and sobbing with his whole body, he began pulling out one by one the glass-topped drawers of the cabinet. In the dim lamplight, the even files of specimens shone silk-like under the glass. Here, in this room, on that very desk, his son had spread the wings of his capture. He would first pin the carefully killed insect in the cork-bottom groove of the setting board, between the adjustable strips of wood, and fasten down flat with pinned strips of paper the still, fresh, soft wings. They had now dried long ago and had been transferred to the cabinet. Those spectacular swallowtails, those dazzling coppers and blues, and the various fritillaries, some mounted in a supine position to display the mother-of-pearl undersides. His son used to pronounce their Latin names with a moan of triumph or in an arch a sigh of disdain. And the moss, the first aspen hawk of 5 summers ago. 4. The night was smoke blue and moonlit. Thin clouds were scattered about the sky but did not touch the delicate icy moon. The trees, masses of gray frost, cast dark shadows on the drifts, which scintillated here and there with metallic sparks. In the plush-upholstered, well-heated room of the annex, Ivan had placed a 2-foot fir tree in a clay pot on the table and was just attaching a candle to its cruciform top when Slepstov returned from the main house, chilled, red-eyed, with gray dust smears on his cheek, carrying a wooden case under his arm. Seeing the Christmas tree on the table, he asked absently, "What's that?" Relieving him of the case, Ivan answered in a low, mellow voice, "There's a holiday coming up tomorrow." "No, take it away," said Slepstov with a frown, while thinking, "Can this be Christmas Eve? How could I have forgotten?" Ivan gently insisted, "It's nice and green. Let it stand for a while." "Please take it away," repeated Slepstov, and bent over the case he had brought. In it he had gathered his son's belongings, the folding butterfly net, the biscuit tin with the pear-shaped cocoon, the spreading board, the pins in their lacquered box, the blue notebook. Half of the first page had been torn out, and its remaining fragments contained part of a French dictation. There followed daily entries, names of captured butterflies, and other notes. "Walked across the bog as far as Borovichi. Raining today, play checkers with father, then read Goncharov's frigate, a deadly bore. Marvelous hot day, rode my bike in the evening, a midge got in my eye, deliberately rode by her Daka twice, but didn't see her." Slepstov raised his head, swallowed something hot and huge. Of whom was his son writing? "Rode my bike as usual," he read on. "Our eyes nearly met. My darling, my love." "This is unthinkable," whispered Slepstov. "I'll never know." He bent over again, avidly deciphering the childish handwriting that slanted up, then curved down in the margin. "Saw a fresh specimen of the Camberwell beauty today. That means autumn is here. Rain in the evening. She has probably left, and we didn't even get acquainted. Farewell, my darling. I feel terribly sad." "He never said anything to me," Slepstov tried to remember, rubbing his forehead with his palm. On the last page, there was an ink drawing, the hind view of an elephant, 2 thick pillars, the corners of 2 ears, and a tiny tail. Slepstov got up. He shook his head, restraining yet another onrush of hideous sobs. "I can't bear it any longer," he drawled between groans, repeating even more slowly, "I can't bear it any longer." "It's Christmas tomorrow," came the abrupt reminder, "and I'm going to die. Of course, it's so simple, this very night." He pulled out a handkerchief and dried his eyes, his beard, his cheeks. Dark streaks remained on the handkerchief. "Death," Slepstov said softly, as if concluding a long sentence. The clock ticked. Frost patterns overlapped on the blue glass of the window. The open notebook shone radiantly on the table. Next to it, the light went through the muslin of the butterfly net and glistened on a corner of the open tin. Slepstov pressed his eyes shut and had a fleeting sensation that earthly life lay before him, totally bared and comprehensible, and ghastly in its sadness, humiliatingly pointless, sterile, devoid of miracles. At that instant, there was a sudden snap, a thin sound like that of an overstretched rubber band breaking. Slepstov opened his eyes. The cocoon in the biscuit tin had burst at its tip, and a black, wrinkled creature the size of a mouse was crawling up the wall above the table. It stopped, holding onto the surface with 6 black, furry feet, and started palpitating strangely. It had emerged from the chrysalid because a man, overcome with grief, had transferred a tin box to his warm room, and the warmth had penetrated its taut leaf and silk envelope. It had awaited this moment so long, had collected its strength so tensely, and now, having broken out, it was slowly and miraculously expanding. Gradually the wrinkled tissues, the velvety fringes, unfurled. The fan-pleated veins grew firmer as they filled with air. It became a wing thing imperceptibly, as a maturing face imperceptibly becomes beautiful. And its wings, still feeble, still moist, kept growing and unfolding, and now they were developed to the limits set for them by God. And there, on the wall, instead of a little lump of life, Instead of a dark mouse was a great Atticus moth like those that fly, bird-like, around lamps in the Indian dusk. And then those thick black wings with a glazy eye spot on each and a purplish bloom dusting their hooked foretips took a full breath under the impulse of tender, ravishing, almost human happiness. And that story was Christmas by Vladimir Nabokov. The next story is A Christmas Tree by Peary Thomas. Two more weeks and it would come around again. Christmas. The year was 1938. I was 10 years old and living with my family in Harlem. Las Navidades was a sacred time for all the devout Christians, regardless of color, for it was in honor of Jesus Christ, who had not even known the comfort of being born in a hospital, since there had been no room at the inn. Instead, he'd been born in a manger in the stable. Poppy, who was a deathbed Catholic, would only see a priest when he was ready to kick the bucket, but when anybody asked him what his faith was, he would proudly boom out, "Me? I'm Católico." For kids in El Barrio, Christmas was a time of great expectations and nighttime dreams of a beautiful yellow bicycle with balloon tires or a brand new pair of ice skates. I dropped hints all over the place, hoping to receive at least one or the other. I would write to Santa Claus asking for what I wanted, always sending my best regards to Mrs. Claus with the hope of establishing a better connection. But the truth of the matter was that nobody heard me. We Thomas children always got something, although not exactly what we had asked for. Our brave, tight smiles with the glimmer of a tear were meant to pass as a happy joy of receiving pretty close to what we wanted. But we sure didn't fool Mommy, who, in gentle tones, would tell us that we ought to be thankful that we had received something, at least, since a lot of ghetto children had not gotten anything because of the great unemployment. The lines at Catholic charities were long, and not everybody in them was Catholic. The 23rd Precinct on 104th Street gave out toys to the kids in our community, and then some of the cops proceeded to bust our chops for the rest of the year. La Casita Maria in El Barrio on 110th Street gave out warm blankets and clothes and bags of groceries, and the Heckscher Foundation on 104th Street was there for us too, and gave shoes and warm clothing to the very poor. Mommy gave each of us a kiss and a tight hug and told us we should give thanks to God that our father had had a job at the toy warehouse for the past 2 years. I smiled in agreement, but with my thoughts I responded, "See, Mommy, but they don't have yellow bikes with balloon tires and pro ice skates." Poppy's boss was named Mr. Charles. Poppy worked as a toy inspector who checked the toys, separating out the damaged ones as rejects. Poppy also served with distinction as packer and porter. Poppy had told us that his boss considered himself to be a good guy, and so at Christmas time he allowed his workers to take home damaged toys as presents for their children. But all the toys Poppy had brought home last Christmas were brand new, with the exception of one single reject among them. As it came out years later, Poppy, who, like many other parents, wanted the best for his children, wanted brand new toys instead of rejects, and had simply put prime condition toys into a large potato sack and then placed a damaged one right on top, bringing them all home in one sack, which made us kids very happy on Christmas morning. Of course, Poppy didn't want Mommy to know, because she, as a good Christian, would disapprove of any action that smacked of dishonesty. It was 4 days before Christmas, and we still had not gotten our tree. Poppy had waited until he got his few dollars Christmas bonus and then announced that it was time to buy our tree and asked us who wanted to come. Of course, all four kids began to squeal and jump around, using any excuse for creating joy. I looked out the window of the living room, which faced the street. The barrio was covered by a soft white blanket of snow that kept falling gently. "Dress warmly," Mommy admonished, and in no time at all the four of us looked like Eskimos, complete with warm scarves that swallowed our faces. As we ran out into the dimly lit hallway and noisily descended the stairs two at a time, I heard Mommy call down to Poppy about not going crazy and spending too much money on the Christmas tree. The five of us stepped out into a white world of falling snow and muffled sounds. The snow looked good enough to eat. We could make snowballs and then pour on flavored syrup and eat the balls like pierogies, Poppy exclaimed. Vaya, kids, look at all the snow. Is it not the most beautiful sight? We all shivered in agreement. Lots of familias with their children were heading toward Third Avenue. We turned the corner on 104th Street and Third, and the avenue was ablaze on both sides of the street, with millions of multicolored Christmas lights blinking at each other all the way up to 125th Street. Loudspeakers hooked to the outside walls of well-stocked stores blared Christmas songs like I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, Joy to the World, and Hark the Herald Angels Sing, with commercial breaks in English and Spanish that promised tremendous bargains with 50% off and instant credit. Jose was anxious to get to the empty lot near Second Avenue because he had been chosen to be the one to pick the tree. We all entered the huge lot full of all sizes and kinds of trees. Poppy led us to where the regular-sized trees were trying to look their scrawny best, and we followed right behind him. That is, all except Jose, who was nowhere to be seen. Everybody took a point on the compass and frantically went Jose hunting. I hoped he had not been kidnapped and held for ransom. Sis ended those lousy thoughts by waving at all of us to come over. We joined her, and as she pointed to the most expensive, taller and fuller trees, there was little Jose, lost in wonder, looking up at one of the tallest and most expensive trees in the lot. I saw Poppy's face like he was remembering what Mommy had said about not going crazy and spending too much money. We all stared at Jose, who turned to us with a big grin on his small face and pointed to what, from his vantage point, must have seemed like a giant redwood straight from California. Poppy smiled at little Jose, and we all followed suit as Poppy tried to persuade Jose that he had to be kidding, trying to steer our little brother toward some Christmas trees more his size, but to no avail. Jose held his ground without a grin and kept his tiny forefinger pointed at the gorgeous tree of his choice. Poppy offered him a delicious hot dog from a nearby stand, knowing that Jose, and us along with him, loved hot dogs with a passion. But Jose was determined not to be moved. His little lips started to quiver and his tiny forefinger was getting tired of pointing, and just before the first tears formed, Frankie, my sister, and I were practically glaring at poor Poppy, who was hung up in the middle with no place to go. Poppy did what he had to do and snatched Jose up in his arms and raised him onto his shoulder and shouted out for Jose and all to hear. "Hey, mister, how much you want for this tree?" Poppy's eyes pleaded with the Negro brother that the price not be too high so that he could please his youngest child along with the rest of the family. The brother, who was an old man of about 30, looked the tree over, lips pursed like he was into a real heavy decision. Poppy finally said, "Well, mister, what's your price?" and added under his breath, "You know if it's too high, I won't be able to deal with it." I watched everyone closely. Their faces were somber. Jose had some tears ready just in case the price was out of the question. "Well, sir, this tree is worth about $10. We gasped. $10 in 1938 was like 2 months' rent and food for months and months. Rice and beans were about 5 cents a pound. Poppy shook his head grimly and did not dare look straight at Jose, who was nibbling his upper lip with his lower. "How much do you have, sir?" asked the mister. "I got a $5 bill from which I got to bring home at least two for the Christmas dinner." Poppy squatted down to Jose's size and offered him a whispered deal of how about getting us a smaller tree and Jose could have a whole dollar all of his own. Jose just shook his head and pointed his tiny forefinger up at his personal Christmas tree. Poppy got up and whispered to the mister, "Say, brother, what's the best you could do?" "Well, I says if you don't mind giving me a hand tomorrow night, you got the tree for $3. What do you say?" "Done deal." Poppy shook hands with the mister and said, "My name is Juan, but I'm known as Johnny." "My name is Matt," and that was that. Poppy gave Matt the worn $5 bill and got $2 in return. Jose put on one of his famous grins, and we all broke out in a victorious cheer. The five of us struggled through the snow until we were across the street in front of our building at 112 East 104th Street. We were living on the top floor, and it suddenly dawned on Poppy that the hallway was too narrow and the turns up the steps were even worse. We tried getting the tree into the hallway, but to no avail unless we wanted to scrape the branches clean. By this time, a small crowd of neighbors had gathered around us, some of whom stopped to greet Poppy and admire Jose's great choice of Christmas tree. Then the debate began on how in the heck we were going to get that 12-foot tree up to our apartment, where the ceiling was only 9 feet high. Some suggested we bind the tree firmly and squeeze and bend it around the banister. Poppy was listening to the suggestions of the men when Mommy, full of curiosity, came downstairs and out onto the street where the small crowd had gotten larger. Mommy quickly sized up the situation and brightly suggested, "Why don't we pull it up the side of the building to the fifth floor and then hand it through the front window?" Everybody smiled and agreed that Mommy's way was the best, and soon Pancho, who had a small truck, came back with a long, strong rope and a small pulley. He and Poppy went up to our apartment and quickly secured the pulley to the side of the fire escape and then ran the rope through it to the street below. By this time, neighbors were serving hot coffee to whoever wanted some and small shots of rum to those who might be extra cold. Everybody seemed to be extra cold. The tall, full Christmas tree was then tied to the rope, and with Poppy on the fifth floor fire escape directing the hauling, Mommy took charge below, with Sis and Frankie watching Jose, who took in the whole scene with a tremendous grin. Tenants appeared on each fire escape, and hands from each of the fire escapes carefully helped guide the tall tree upward until it reached the fifth floor without the loss of a single branch. Poppy and Pancho pulled the big tree in amidst a mighty cheer that rose up from the muffled street below, the sound of victory brought about by the unity of neighbors. After all that, the tree did not fit in our apartment. But Poppy was not to be defeated, so he measured it carefully, and Pancho sawed off 3 feet, finally making it the right size. Then Mommy had us carry the 3 feet of Christmas tree down to Abuela Santiago, who lived alone but had almost everybody in the building for an adopted family. Mommy took some lights and trimmings and went down to her apartment with Jose so he could be the one to do most of the decorating, and Abuela blessed us after we finished. I thought that this promised to be a fine Christmas indeed. When Christmas morning finally dawned, my siblings and I dashed out of our bedrooms to look under Jose's tree, which was now brightly decorated with multicolored Christmas lights blinking on and off. Lo and behold, underneath the tree, in full view of the world, was a pair of ice skates just like the pros used, and on closer look, who the heck cared if they were secondhand, fresh from the Salvation Army thrift store? They were professional skates, and that was all I cared about. Vaya, next year might just bring the beautiful yellow bike with balloon tires. Merry Christmas, I began to shout, and my siblings followed my example. Soon we were joined by happy kids in the hallway, stomping up and down the stairs, shouting, Merry Christmas and Feliz Navidad to one another. Punto. And that story was A Christmas Tree by Piri Toss. The next story is Christmas Every Day by William Dean Howells. Well, once there was a little girl who liked Christmas so much that she wanted it to be Christmas every day in the year. And as soon as Thanksgiving was over, she began to send postal cards to the old Christmas fairy to ask if she mightn't have it. In about 3 weeks, or just the day before Christmas it was, she got a letter from the fairy saying she might have Christmas every day for a year, and then they would see about having it longer. The little girl was a good deal excited already, preparing for the old-fashioned once-a-year Christmas that was coming the next day, and perhaps the fairy's promise didn't make such an impression on her as it would have made at some other time. She just resolved to keep it to herself and surprise everybody with it as it kept coming true, and then it slipped out of her mind altogether. She had a splendid Christmas. She went to bed early so as to let Santa Claus have a chance at the stockings, and in the morning she was up the first of anybody and went and felt them, and found hers all lumpy with packages of candy and oranges and grapes and pocketbooks and rubber balls and all kinds of small presents, just as they always had every Christmas. Then she waited around till the rest of the family were up, and she was the first to burst into the library when the doors were opened and look at the large presents laid out on the library table. books and dolls and little stoves and dozens of handkerchiefs and inkstands and skates and snow shovels and photograph frames and little easels and boxes of watercolors and candied cherries and dolls' houses and the big Christmas tree lighted and standing in the middle. She had a splendid Christmas all day. She ate so much candy that she did not want any breakfast. And the whole forenoon the presents kept pouring in, and she went round giving the presents she had got for other people, and came home and ate turkey and cranberry for dinner, and plum pudding and nuts and raisins and oranges and more candy, and then went and coasted and came in with a stomach ache, crying, and they had a light supper, and pretty early everybody went to bed, cross. The little girl slept very heavily, and she slept very late, but she was awakened at last by the other children dancing round her bed with their stockings full of presents in their hands. "What is it?" said the little girl, and she rubbed her eyes and tried to rise up in bed. "Christmas! Christmas! Christmas!" they all shouted and waved their stockings. "Nonsense! It was Christmas yesterday." Her brothers and sisters just laughed. "We don't know about that. It's Christmas today, anyway. You come into the library and see." Then all at once it flashed on the little girl that the fairy was keeping her promise and her year of Christmases was beginning. She was dreadfully sleepy, but she sprang up like a lark that had overeaten itself and gone to bed cross, and darted into the library. There it was again, the Christmas tree blazing away and the family picking out their presents, but looking pretty sleepy, and her father perfectly puzzled and her mother ready to cry. "I'm sure I don't see how I'm to dispose of all these things," said her mother, and her father said it seemed to him they had something just like it the day before, but he must have dreamed it. Well, the next day it was just the same thing over again, but everybody getting crosser, and at the end of a week's time so many people had lost their tempers that they perfectly strewed the ground. Even when people tried to recover their tempers, they usually got somebody else's, and it made the most dreadful mix. The little girl began to get frightened, keeping the secret all to herself. She wanted to tell her mother, but she didn't dare to, and she was ashamed to ask the fairy to take back her gift. It seemed ungrateful, and she thought she would try to stand it, but she hardly knew how she could for a whole year. So it went on, and it was Christmas on St. Valentine's Day and Washington's birthday just the same as any day, and it didn't skip even the 1st of April, although everything was counterfeit that day, and there was some little relief. After a while, turkeys got to be so scarce that they were about $1,000 apiece, and they got to passing off almost anything for turkey. And the cranberries, well, they asked a dimed apiece for cranberries. All the woods and orchards were cut down for Christmas trees, and where the woods and orchards used to be, it looked just like a stubble field with the stumps. After a while, they had to make Christmas trees out of rags and stuff them with bran, like old-fashioned dolls. But there were plenty of rags, because people got so poor buying presents for one another that they couldn't get any new clothes, and they just wore their old ones to tatters. It was perfectly shameful. Well, after it had gone on about 3 or 4 months, the little girl, whenever she came into the room in the morning and saw those great, ugly, lumpy stockings dangling at the fireplace and the disgusting presents around everywhere, used to sit down and burst out crying. In 6 months, she was perfectly exhausted. She couldn't even cry anymore. She just slammed her presents across the room. By that time, people didn't carry presents around nicely anymore. They flung them over the fence or through the window or anything, and instead of taking great pains to write for dear Papa or Mama or brother or sister or Susie or Sammy or Billy or whoever it was, and troubling to get the spelling right and then signing their names and Christmas 1880-something, they used to write in the gift books, "Take it, you horrid old thing," and then go and bang it against the front door. Nearly everybody had built barns to hold their presents, but pretty soon the barns overflowed, and then they used to let them lie out in the rain or anywhere. Sometimes the police used to come and tell them to shovel their presents off the sidewalk or they would arrest them. Well, before it came Thanksgiving, it had leaked out who had caused all these Christmases. The little girl had suffered so much that she talked about it in her sleep, and after that hardly anybody would play with her. People just perfectly despised her because if it had not been for her greediness, it wouldn't have happened, And now, when it came Thanksgiving and she wanted them to go to church and have squash pie and turkey and show their gratitude, they said that all the turkeys had been eaten up for her old Christmas dinners, and if she would stop the Christmases, they would see about the gratitude. And the very next day, the little girl began to send letters to the Christmas fairy and then telegrams to stop it. But it didn't do any good, and then she got to calling at the fairy's house. But the girl that came to the door always said, not at home, or engaged, or at dinner, or something like that. And so it went on until it came to the old once-a-year Christmas Eve. The little girl fell asleep, and when she woke up in the morning, it wasn't Christmas at last. Well, there was the greatest rejoicing all over the country, and it extended clear up into Canada. The people met together everywhere and kissed and cried for joy. The city carts went around and gathered up all the candy and raisins and nuts and dumped them into the river, and it made the fish perfectly sick. And the whole United States, as far out as Alaska, was one blaze of bonfires, where the children were burning their gift books and presents of all kind. They had the greatest time. The little girl went to thank the old fairy because she had stopped it being Christmas, and she said she hoped she would keep her promise and see that Christmas never, never came again. Then the fairy frowned and asked her if she was sure she knew what she meant, and the little girl asked her why not, and the old fairy said that now she was behaving just as greedily as ever and she'd better look out. This made the little girl think it all over carefully again, and she said she would be willing to have it Christmas about once a thousand years. And then she said 100, and then she said 10, and at last she got down to 1. Then the fairy said that was a good old way that had pleased people ever since Christmas began, and she was agreed. And that story was Christmas Every Day by William Dean Howells from A Family Christmas, selected by Caroline Kennedy. And that's the end of this Christmas program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.